Welcome to the Ancient Christian Writers series, led by Father David Abernethy of the Pittsburgh Oratory of St. Philip Neri in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. The following recording is a reading and discussion of The Spiritual Life by St. Theophane the Recluse. Our ability to provide podcasts free of charge is made possible by the generosity of listeners like you. If you would like to make a contribution in support of our ministries, please visit www.thepittsburghoratory.org. Your interest and prayerful support are appreciated. God bless you and enjoy the podcast.
Our hope is in the name of the Lord, who made heaven and earth. Okay, welcome back, everybody, to our study of St. Theophane's correspondence to the young Anastasia. And we're coming towards the end of the work. And so, as you might remember, Anastasia's made a decision to enter into religious life. And yet, for the time being, she's still living at home. And so, in these final letters, he's engaging her about some of the trials that she's having that are either pushing her forward to act too quickly or act willfully in the sense of moving immediately to join a community, or that might be calling into question her decision. And so he's trying to help her navigate these kind of things. And as we mentioned last time, he can be rather direct with her. And as we'll see in the coming letters, very direct. And we know that he has great love and affection for her. But I think with some of these, he's being firm, knowing the challenge that's going to come to her. I think, you know, as a person approaches something like entering religious life, that there are going to be some unique but also intensified temptations that one would have to struggle with. But also in preparing her for the religious life itself, that he wants her to have, you know, a strong awareness of what goes on within the heart, the changeability often of our minds and hearts, and that he wants her to be aware of and to avoid. And so, he can be very firm with her in these last few letters. And so, again, we're on the very last paragraph on page 289 of the text. The paragraph, you are saying, I suppose I'm a great sinner, and the Lord is punishing me. It is good that you feel yourself to be a sinner, and if you come to feel yourself to be a greater sinner, do not go too far with this feeling. So she's beginning to experience some of these temptations and the frustration with herself, you know, as he's sort of rebuked her and counselor. And so she acknowledges it, but also he doesn't want her to slip into a kind of despondency here. I mean, I think some of the things that as one is growing in, you know, holiness and grace, and as one is about ready to make a commitment such as this, that there can be certain sins that we would fall into that are deeply humbling, you know, or we can see an immaturity within ourselves, a kind of pride arise about certain things that creates a kind of sensitivity of mind within us, where we begin to snap about different things, or to argue with others, or generally just to be operating under a spirit of frustration. And I think she begins to see these things in her, and he wants her to let them humble her, to acknowledge them in order that she might turn away from them, but not, again, to lead her into despondency. I think this would be one of the desires of the evil one as she's approaching a vocation, is to lead her into a deep kind of sadness where she would call into question altogether the decision to enter, feeling herself, you know, inadequate, which may be true, but seeing it in such a way as that she's outside of the grace of God, and that somehow it's a mistake for her to enter. And so this is what he wants to protect her from. All of us are great sinners and irredeemable. It's sort of an interesting thought that he puts forward there, that in reality, you know, we don't redeem ourselves, and there's nothing that we can do to redeem ourselves. That redemption comes through Christ and through the mercy of God. And it is this that she wants to cast herself upon and not feel that she has to, you know, work her way out of this lowly state that she sees herself in. If you will make an opportunity out of your sinfulness, there will be no misfortune. Just do not reverse your inner decisions and do not fall into despair. No matter what the Lord sends, whether inwardly or outwardly, all is directed toward our cleansing and salvation. He himself is close by and helps. He is close by you too. Resurrect such hope and prayer while enduring. And so she is not to see the Lord as absent from these challenges that she's having. And she might even see herself in some sense regressing somewhat in the spiritual life. But she does not want to see this outside of the movements or the providence of God. That is precisely at times like this that God can allow this kind of deep humbling where one sees oneself as unfit or even immature, so that one would take this step in a spirit of humility, that it would be casting oneself upon the grace and the mercy of God and entering into it not with a kind of self-assuredness that, you know, one has certain gifts or talents and abilities that, you know, raises them above that profound need for God's grace. Eric, your dog is being a distraction, I'm sorry to say. Eric Chastain. Okay. The Lord sends this and things like it for the sake of crowns. He who stands his ground will win a cross. We and those around us and those whom we encounter are all capable of obtaining crowns. You just need attention and courage so that you receive everything from God and attribute everything to him. Enjoy yourself peacefully and do not tolerate any hesitations. Lord, give the blessing. So if the Lord allows these things to happen and these kinds of severe temptations or trials to happen, it is ordered that greater crowns would be achieved in the sense of crowns of virtue, that her virtue would be perfected and all that she has been striving for over these past years, all that she has received from his counsel might come to a greater perfection as she prepares to make this step. So not to become discouraged, even again, if she sees herself in some sense regressing or falling to sin or falling into pride, that God isn't absent there. Throw herself upon his mercy and he will raise her up. He'll offer her the comfort that she needs at this moment. And it's an important counsel for us in the spiritual life, because no matter how far we have progressed or how many years we've been involved in our particular vocation and how many years we've been striving or how many years we've been ordained or married, you know, I think there's always this capacity within us through negligence or just lack of attentiveness to what's going on or this kind of sensitivity of spirit that we can find ourselves falling into these kinds of regressions that are almost like a kind of immaturity. We see ourselves acting out in all different kinds of ways. And in some ways, these can be even more deeply humiliating than certain, maybe more concrete sins, you know, where we catch sight of ourselves as struggling under this poverty of spirit, where, you know, we are, you know, immature and spiritually and perhaps emotionally, or that we have this capacity if something triggers us or if the right buttons are pushed, that out of us can arise a profound impatience or a deep anger, deep-seated anger towards others. And so, it, you know, you begin to see why he wants her to be aware of this so that she doesn't become discouraged. And the same would be true for all of us. You know, there are going to be times in our life where we see ourselves as profoundly weak, and that God allows us to see that in order that perhaps the most important virtue would be perfected, and that would be humility, that we know that all things come to us from the hand of God. Okay, any comments about these final paragraphs or this letter as a whole? All right. Well, we'll move on to letter 76. And he begins to deal with her. He's in these three letters, he's dealing with specific temptations that are coming to her at this time. And, one is, specific tricks of the enemy to trip her up, to make her question her decision. The next will be temptations from unbelievers. So those that she encounters in her day-to-day life that are questioning her faith, questioning her decision, and how she's supposed to respond in the face of this. And so he begins, "May the grace of God be upon you. Well now, no sooner did you manage to escape the first burden than another one, more subtle and more dangerous, is already waiting. Who is there with you who is carrying on so? Did he not tell you a bunch of stories and cram a lot of worthless garbage into your head? His aim is to make your faith waver, and not only to divert you from Christ the Lord, but also to make you a total atheist. It was the enemy who sent you, such a clever, wise man." And, in the past letters, we've heard him tell her that the nature of the evil one and the demons is this ability to lounge around and watch for patterns or to bring about these, connections like this relationship that she's had with this man that she came into contact with, to watch for those moments of vulnerability and seek to influence her decision. And so here she comes into a contact with someone who is intelligent, who's articulate, who can test her faith by the things that he's saying, call it into question on multiple levels. And in the process, he's filling her mind with all these things that could lead her into doubt. And as we'll see, he's pretty clear about what she should do, that not only is she supposed to be vigilant in this, but she's also to avoid it altogether, to see it for what it is, a temptation. This is not an opportunity for her to have a dialogue with someone or a friend that she has happened to meet, but rather it's a specific temptation that has come to her at this moment of her life in order to try to make her vulnerable and again to call into question the decision. He says, "You made the right decision, that is to avoid in every way conversations with non-believers and any meetings with them. Evil conversations spoil the good attitude of the soul. Try to struggle and restore order afterward. But you will not be saved from danger. These evil creatures stick their noses into everything. Look around, and they are there. In the future, act in this way. When by chance you happen to overhear something that goes against your religious faith, try in every way not to let what you have heard into your heart, but let it go in one ear and out the other. At the same time, while drawing the attention away from the words of a non-believer, take care to occupy the heart with the conviction that our faith is indisputably true in all aspects. And if it has enemies, this is from a misunderstanding of the matter. It is possible to dispute everything, even whether we exist. The restored conviction in our heart, accompanied by thought about the narrow-mindedness and bad-heartedness of the speaker, will make your soul like a rock against which foolish words, when striking, will bounce off and leaving no traces." And so he's very clear with her here that even if the person isn't consciously aware of it, that there is a malicious spirit behind this seeking to undermine the good attitude of the soul, that here she has been striving for years to form the mind and the heart to be more and more open to God and responsive to his grace, to develop not only the attitudes of mind, but the practices on the ascetical level in order to order her desires toward God. And so even if it arises out of misunderstanding upon this individual's part, her response is to remain firmly rooted on her faith, in her faith, and to, as it were, let it go in one ear and out the other. Don't let it penetrate the heart, in the sense that we give it weight, or certainly the weight of the gospel, or that we place it on equal footing with what has been revealed to us over the course of years in the spiritual life and in one's relationship with God. And this can be a jarring situation. I think when one encounters an individual such as this, and they come with, you know, force with a kind of practice knowledge, certainly in their area, to call into question all that we hold dear. And sometimes, you know, those with a sensitive heart and those certainly seeking to be charitable might feel that they have a kind of obligation to enter into that. And I think it's important for us to understand that that's not true. You know, our obligation is to protect the mind and the heart and to guard ourselves against any kind of temptation that might come to us. And not out of a kind of false charity or a sense of goodwill or this sense that we have this obligation to engage in this dialogue and thereby, you know, put ourselves in a situation where our faith can be diminished. I think Eric Williams went up first and then Eric Chastain.
Yeah. Nothing particularly deep, and it actually may have come up in a previous session that I missed, but these last letters in particular are making me think of this as almost like the anti-Screwtape letters. Mm-hmm. You know, these imagined letters of demons to each other. This is sort of the flip side. This is, you know, the counseling and advice to the soul that's being influenced by said demons. It's the two together would probably make some interesting reading for like Lent or something like that.
Yeah, it's very good because these letters in particular have that character where he's sort of laying out for her the subtleties of the temptations that come. And, I think maybe we are used to this in our day in multiple forums where the faith is attacked in one way or another. And certainly we've provided enough material for people to attack the church endlessly. But, you know, nonetheless, I think we have that same responsibility that I think Theophan is putting before us. You know, it's our own purity of heart, our own desire for God, the depth of our faith that is most important. And, you know, there's part of us that thinks that we need to be informed about all the things that are going on in the world, or that we have this obligation to stand up and refute some individuals, when oftentimes the impetus behind their desire to enter into these discussions is simply kind of chaos. Or, you know, they've been wrapped themselves in a kind of nihilism that, you know, holds on to nothing and believes in nothing. And so what would want to disrupt that when they see any kind of firm faith in another? And I think too often we expose ourselves with great freedom to things, you know, not only those things that are obviously sinful, but I think those things that he describes here as being more subtle, those things that could undermine our faith. And I think today, even, you know, watching television or the news, you know, and we tell ourselves, you know, we need to be informed about these things. But I think we all know that there's this kind of repetitive cycle. And for whatever reason they do it and why this has become the norm, the effects of it are the same, as well as a kind of sensationalization of the different things that are going on within the world. And so this repetitive cycle, and then making everything is, everything comes up with breaking news, even though it's been repeated 20 times earlier in the day, it's always breaking news, as if it's there's something essential that one would be attentive to here. And a steady dose of this can lead a person into deep despondency or fear that, you know, the world's falling apart, everything's out of control. And on the surface, it's that seems to be the case. You know, when we look around the world, on a surface level, that's hard to dispute. But on the level of faith, we know that God's presence and hand is within everything. And though, and so even though there seems to be chaos within the world, there's also, and in an even more powerful way, an abundance of God's grace at work. Where sin abounds, grace abounds all the more, Paul tells us. And we often forget that, that in the face of all the great evils that we see within the world and even within the church, there's also God's grace at work, most likely in more hidden ways, and certainly not something that's going to be flashed across the news. And so we do well to protect our hearts, because even though these things might not be an assault upon the faith directly, they're still assaulting our faith by pulling us into a kind of darkness and despair about what is going on around us. And it can be foolhardy on our part to expose ourselves to that too much. It's one thing to want to stay informed about things going on in the world. It's another thing to slowly poison ourselves upon the things that I've just described. And that's what takes place. It's kind of poisoning of the mind and the heart. And that's why Theophan tells her, you know, let things go in one ear and out the other. Because if you let it enter into the heart, it's going to disrupt your peace and create a deep kind of agitation for you. Eric Chastain.
It's very, it's very hard to be a scientist. Mm-hmm. And follow this advice in the sense that I actually in my own job, I have found myself actually not eating lunch with my lab mates at all. Mm-hmm. I used to eat lunch with them, but then they would do things like this. I mean, not specifically about the faith, but about, you know, various heretical things like questioning the nature of marriage. Why does anybody get married ever? Or, you know, things like this. This happens pretty frequently, or various other things. And, you know, even just having meetings, sometimes they kind of like push into areas that are kind of inappropriate because they are very, I don't know, that's just their style. Or, you know, I mean, even there are some scientific problems where people try to account for the origin of you know, a rational soul in humans only using evolution, mm-hmm. which is contrary to church doctrine, you know. So it's like, I have to endure and listen to and still somehow be sitting present during these conversations. And I just don't know what to do. I just don't know what to do. So I just either disengage, or I'm not there, or, you know, I don't know. Yeah. So whatever your advice is.
Yeah, I think my advice is to not see yourself as alone in that. Now, I don't think it's unique to the field of science. I think I hear from people on a daily basis, whether they're students or they work in any number of fields, that certainly any expression of the faith, or if you had an icon on your desk, there would be heck to pay, as it were. But, you know, there is this kind of freedom and, you know, mocking the faith, mocking the church, belittling people because of their faith or their beliefs. And I think many people are confronted with this on a day-to-day basis. you know, but our responsibility is to study the, if you will, the science of sciences, you know, what we receive from the fathers, and let that to form the mind and the heart. You know, we're under no obligation to immerse ourselves in things that are going to undermine our faith. And I think if our work environment does that to us, then it probably shouldn't be our work environment. And, you know, I think there are particular sacrifices that one might have to make to say, you know, if I'm putting myself in jeopardy in this, or again, that this has become such a toxic environment in regards to the faith, I might have to make a hard decision. And, you know, I think that's often not supported. You know, I think many people, again, will think, well, you know, Christians are to be a kind of leaven and sort of be engaged in the culture. But if the culture that you're engaged in and everyone surrounding you has a kind of animosity towards the faith, I think the cost of that to the individual is greater than the value of remaining in that. And, you know, unless one were, you know, had this heroic sanctity, or there was some kind of specific call to do that. But, you know, our life is short, and, you know, what we're responsible for is serving God and living a holy life. And, you know, I think if there's something there that jeopardizes that, then we might have to cut it off, in the same way that if there is something in our life in general that leads us into sin. You know, Christ said, if your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. If your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out. And so if there's something that is an impediment that gets in the field of our vision of God, then why would we not remove it? And even if it were our own eye, you know, in the sense of costing us this kind of purity of heart or this clarity in seeing the truth, you know, that we would sacrifice it. And I think the further we get away from some of the challenging things of the gospel, the more that we're willing to make, you know, sacrifices where perhaps we should not make sacrifices. And we are sort of drawn into this narrative and rhetoric of tolerance in our day, you know, which basically means tolerating everything except Christianity, or, you know, and so that we should allow ourselves to remain in those circumstances. And I'm not saying that we are to be thin-skinned as Christian men and women, but, you know, our heart and the peace of Christ within our heart is far more important than engaging in these endless dialogues, and, or, you know, not even dialogues, it's typically a diatribe, you know, against the faith. You know, again, our peace of heart and the peace of Christ is worth far more than that. Now, that would probably weed out a lot of places for us in this world. And, you know, living in a university community, I think I can understand why a lot of people are rethinking things. And even in terms of the whole homeschooling movement, I get it. You know, when I hear some things that have gone on even in Catholic schools, you know, where teachers on their lunch break are going out to have their palms read, it's like, oh my gosh, you know, this is crazy. Why would you, you know, send a child there? And so we can't assume that certain environments are going to be fruitful for ourselves and our own formation, or formation of those in our care. Andrea and Anthony.
Yes, Father, just a small comment, because this kind of hit home for me, you know, what he was saying, to stay away from people who are going to challenge your faith in this kind of just very aggressive way. And it hit home for me, because in my youth, I was this clever, wise man that he's talking about. Mm-hmm. And there was nothing that you could have said to me that would cause me to change my beliefs and talking to me, since I knew enough about Christianity to poke holes at it would cause damage to you. Mm-hmm. So it's really, as you said, false charity to try to engage a person like that. It would have been false charity to try to engage me at that point in my life. And it's prudent to protect oneself from such influences.
Yeah, you know, I think the whole idea of being, you know, wise as serpents, but innocent as doves, and that there is kind of wisdom there where we have to have a kind of judgment about what is, you know, what is going to bear fruit and what will not. And as a young priest, I remember walking out of the oratory with, I think, my sister and brother-in-law and nieces, and I caught somebody out of the side of my eye walking next to us and got the feeling that he wanted to say something to me, you know. And as a priest, I turned over and I turned around and said hello, and I said, how are you doing today? And he said, not so good, Father. And he said, I'm a terrible sinner and there's no hope for me. And so as a priest, you think, you know, I have the responsibility, you know, to engage this guy. And which I did, you know, started to talk to him about the mercy of God. And, you know, he began to probe a little bit more, you know, in terms of, well, how that forgiveness is found. And the moment that there was a turn in the conversation that included a sacramental worldview or the sense of, you know, the experience of God's mercy in this concrete way, he turned, and he turned vicious. And he turned out to be one of the, you know, street preachers, but a really incredibly anti-Catholic one, and began to attack the church, our building, the collar that I had in my shirt, everything you could possibly imagine he was throwing at me. And at one point I had to say, you know, take care, goodbye. You know, that it was aware that there wasn't a generosity of spirit with which he was approaching me, or a genuine desire to enter into a dialogue, that it was a kind of setup in order to try to undermine my belief. And in that, you know, there's something deeply deceptive about that. And this was even, you know, as this was a person even who was a man of faith, you know, as he said. And but yet there was a kind of deceptiveness with which he approached me and received goodwill from me. And there is a certain point where you have to cut things off. And even Newman, I've told this story in a couple of groups. He had correspondence with a Protestant man for many years, you know, and including throughout the time when he was sort of discerning becoming Catholic. And after he had converted to Catholicism, a good number of years later, the man wrote to him wanting to, you know, if they could pick up their correspondence again. And Newman basically told him no, that they had covered all the territory that they could, and that they had basically become like two different species trying to communicate with each other, like a duck and a dog, I think is the term that he used, the phrase that he used. And I thought, gee, that's sort of surprising from someone like Newman, who certainly had engaged the world and others, and even did this very public, offered this very public a kind of apology or description for why he converted to Catholicism. And so wasn't afraid of talking about the faith with anyone, but had realized that with this particular individual, that they were moving along parallel paths that would never cross. And that the time for both of them would be better spent perhaps in prayer or engaged in other work. And I know that's a little far afield from what we've been talking about here, but I don't think we want to be constantly dragged along, I think, by one conversation after another with this sense of an obligation to do so, because some of these can be driven, as he's telling Anastasia here, by a malicious underlying spirit, even if the individual who's engaged in it isn't altogether conscious of that. And so we have to be willing to guard our hearts and be discerning, and in order to be able to see these things when they are taking place. Miron and Sarah, Father Miron and Sarah. Hello.
Sorry, we're slow here. I was just making comment about Father Miron Sr. He has a book study also, and this conversation has kind of come up in the field that's what they're reading. And one thing that I always think about is there was a woman who wanted to tell us, you know, I feel this like strong urge and desire to defend my faith at all times. And, you know, when people are talking bad about the faith or bad about Catholicism or, you know, whatever it is, I just feel like I have to stand up and say something. And Father Miron said, God doesn't need defended. And like that always like resounds in my head that, yes, there are times where you defend the faith, but most of the time, God doesn't need defended. And also people that are challenging you aren't doing it out of
wanting to know more.
Yeah, wanting to know or genuine need or curiosity. They're looking to attack you. So why start and engage in the conversation in the first place?
Right. Yeah, I've come across multiple. That's very good. Thanks. And I've come across multiple quotes like this from the saints, you know, where they are able to see if they're, you know, if a person really isn't interested in the truth, talking to them about it is not going to bear fruit. That, you know, faith, as we've talked about before, is a gift. And we're not going to argue somebody into the faith. Not that we should hold back and taking opportune moments to engage them about it, but in the end, it is still a gift. And so more often than not, we can do more for individuals by getting on our knees and praying, you know, in particular for that gift of faith, than we can by badgering them. Or, you know, certainly by engaging again in these endless kinds of conversation where, again, there isn't this kind of hermeneutic of generosity that exists, you know, this interpretive approach to what another person is saying that is open to listening, that is willing to suspend judgment and really listens on a deep level to what the other person is saying with the hope of understanding and grasping their perspective on things. I think it's rare that we find individuals in our day that have that capacity to hold even two contradictory ideas in the mind at the same time is a sign of a kind of intellectual, emotional, and spiritual maturity, that one can do that and not be undone. Most often we're too defensive and defended to be able to suspend that judgment and to really listen to the person with that kind of spirit of generosity. More often than not, it's a kind of hermeneutic of suspicion with which we approach people, that we listen and approach them with this suspicious attitude about what they're saying. But what happens there is that we are not listening to the person and to what they're saying, that we can be formulating in our minds already what we want to say in response, anticipating what we would say to them. And so oftentimes others will do that with us. And there can be a profound lack of charity and respect in that, you know, when we aren't really giving our full attention to the person. In a subtle way, we've lost sight of the dignity of the other and not being willing to hear what they say and to engage them. And so, you know, it's important for us to be able to discern that in others, but also to really cultivate it in our own hearts so that we are approaching people with that kind of generosity too, including those who have, you know, problems with church teaching and things like that. I think we really want to work to understand, you know, what it is that they're struggling with, or, you know, what the impediment there is in terms of their acceptance of this or that teaching of the faith. And it might be rooted in something that really isn't at the heart of the faith, or perhaps it's even more personal. Maybe they've been wounded on some level. And so, you know, we take these opportunities to engage people and engage them in love and to articulate the faith to the best of our ability. But getting back to our text, we have to discern really what's going on there. And again, not only with the other person, but with at times the malicious spirit that might be trying to trip us up, depending on what's going on in our spiritual life. Discrimination is a good thing when it comes to the spiritual life, in the sense of being able to discriminate what is going on and in a particular situation and what the root cause of something is, that we have this discerning mind. And we don't want to set that aside, or else we're going to be blown like a reed in the wind every time somebody says or does something to us. Which letter are we discussing? We're on letter 76, Philip, and we're on page, where are we at, 291 now? Yes, 291. Okay. So I think we're down at the third paragraph, right? I lost track there for a second. Okay. If, in spite of this, something bad sinks into the soul, turn to prayer in the very same way you did at St. Sergius Lavra. Appeal to your guardian angel, the Mother of God, and especially the Lord our Savior himself, and they will disperse the gloom hanging over you. Afterward, either do your own examination of the bewilderment that befell you, or seek refutation of it in some book, or talk it over with someone. But without fail, do something so that no trace of it is left in your soul. Any remaining trace would stir up the soul and be like stones cast at the feet of a pedestrian. So leave no trace of it. So leave no trace, not only of what somebody might say to us, but the agitation that it might stir within the heart, the sorrow, the frustration, anger, that we are to leave no trace of that within us. Anything that can pull us into a kind of state of despondency or pull us out of the peace of Christ that can cloud our vision is something to be set aside. Because at this level of discernment, you know, when she is struggling on multiple levels, as we'll see, it can be something very subtle that throws her off track altogether. So she really wants to keep her focus intently upon Christ, to be listening to him, to be seeking the intercession of Our Lady, her guardian angel, to deepen her prayer, if anything, at this point. Okay. Right. If in spite of this, I'm sorry, I already said that. Write me too. You did well to write everything you heard. Although you did not waver and have recovered from everything that lodged in your thought from this conversation, I would say, however, another word or two to counter it. Religious faith is instilled through education. It does not instill it, but it develops it and gives it a definite form. Every newborn enters into society that has faith. The faith of society becomes his faith, as with other things. An aptitude for faith, however, and its requirement for the soul are not instilled by society. It is the same with respect to knowledge. Society, through education, transmits the knowledge it has accumulated to its new member, but does not give him the aptitude for knowledge. This aptitude is an inherent property of the mind. Likewise, faith in the existence of God and his almightiness is an inherent property of the spirit, which is found with vitality in each person as soon as his aptitudes are developed. Society transmits only the way of its faith, but not the power of belief itself or aptitude for it. So interesting, you know, he leads her down what might seem to be, or he seems to be taking her, you know, along this little digression here, in terms of understanding the nature of faith as being something infused, and that actually is a part of every person, that within us, in us, is this inherent quality to believe and know God, that is a gift that is given to us, an infused virtue, and that education, formation in the faith, helps foster that aptitude. And our capacity to know God in a deeper way. And one would say, you know, part of this education and formation would be also the ascetical life, the life of prayer, liturgy, you know, everything that forms and shapes the mind and the heart. And but we want to understand that every person made in the image and likeness of God has this inherent ability to know God that has been given to them. And, you know, I think so often in our culture, there is this desire to say, well, you were born into this, or that this is something that you've been influenced, you know, to by, you know, certain individuals, or that it is simply the product of the culture. And I think what Theophan is saying to her, no, it's part of our very nature as human beings created in the image and likeness of God. God has made us for himself. And, you know, as Augustine said, we are restless until we rest in thee, that it's, you know, God has created us not only with his capacity for knowing him, but also a longing for him and a longing within us that can only be filled by him. And so it shouldn't come as a surprise to us that we see this sort of consistency throughout the world and through cultures of this kind of religion, of longing within the human heart, that for us it should make perfect sense if we understand ourselves as created in an image and likeness of God. But we also believe in a revealed religion where God has made himself manifest to us, has revealed himself perfectly within his Son, that he's shown us the particular path to him, he's redeemed us, he's given us his own spirit. You know, these are all the things that help to cultivate and deepen that faith and deepen our aptitude, our understanding of it, that we might embrace it fully. And, you know, I think when we look, you know, a lot of parents will say, well, I'm going to let my child choose for himself. And, you know, when he gets old enough. But in some sense, you would be neglecting as parents to form that aptitude. You know, God has created in this way for himself. But if you neglect educating them in it and helping develop that aptitude, then more likely than not, they are going to be influenced by the culture around them that is actively seeking to form them in particular ways, given whatever generation they live in. And in a generation like ours, there is a very aggressive culture, secularized culture, that is going to, you know, impose upon them, or, you know, give to them this particular view of the human person, and this particular view of the self, not as connected to God, but as independent from God. Anthony.
For what it's worth, my educational background is in political theory, okay? Mm-hmm. And I don't remember if this is an original idea to me or if I initially got it from somebody else. But free speech has often been used as a tool of subversives. I might have got this from E. Michael Jones. And he's right, I think. The English Protestants insisted on it. If I remember right, the communists insisted on it. All of these things, our American society insists on it. And all of it does is to get ideas out in our culture, which we have to say, we have to let them. I'm going to die for your right to say something. Okay, fine. But you're putting garbage in libraries to suck kids into the worst vices. And it undermines our Catholic religion, which is objective truth. It's just absolutely terrible. So... Mm-hmm. I agree with St. Theophan.
Yeah. And I think one can understand. I think, you know, people coming to this country understood the importance of that formation in the faith, you know, the cultivation of it. And that's why we see the development of the parochial school system to help do that, you know, to protect that which was, you know, such a central part of their life. And when we see that diminish, and there's no one there to help cultivate that, how quickly that Catholic culture collapses, and how little influence then the Christian culture has upon society as a whole. And now things have swung in the opposite direction, that we've handed over the formation of ourselves and of children to that which is absurd, that prior generations wouldn't even thought of doing it. And, you know, the whole, you know, issues surrounding gender and things such as that, you know, it's mind-boggling at times, you know, especially in regards to little children, where one would have to say that it's akin to abuse. And I don't even think we have to speak that softly about it. I mean, I think it's pretty clearly that. And so, you know, I think the point here that he's making to her is an important one for us to internalize, and that, you know, that we are given this gift of faith, that it, but we are responsible for forming this aptitude for understanding of it on all the different levels that we've been given by God and by the church, and that we have this responsibility to others and to our children. And if we fail in that purpose, we are going to experience the consequence of it. You know, even as a student, I was a liberal studies student, you know, when I started thinking about the priesthood, so I could study philosophy, history, psychology, you know, these were the things that I sort of had immersed myself in. But every once in a while, I'd take these courses, especially offered in the summer. And once I took this course on the rhetoric of cynicism. And it was sort of fascinating, but it was the writing of the Beat generation. So it would be writers like Jack Kerouac, you know, like 1950s, he wrote that book On the Road. And it was like nothing had meaning. And it was like this drug-addled stream of consciousness writing, you know, and just sort of living life in the moment, but not being guided and directed by anything other than the satisfying of one's own desires. And by the end of that course, I think I was in a depressed state because I had read all of these books by these individuals that were formed by that generation and wrote for that generation. And, you know, under the guise of a kind of freedom, you know, or that this was something that was prized and valued, you begin to see that there was really a profound emptiness within it. And that everything described in the books, you know, showed like this kind of deep hopelessness underneath it all. You know, it was presented in this, you know, guise of being interesting or avant-garde, you know, and but in the end, it was filled with a deep hopelessness of this existence without God. So what he's doing here, I think, is pretty important. He's trying to establish in her mind what is most central to her existence as a human being and why she is responsible for protecting it. Society instills faith through education, but just how did belief come into society? Everything that goes into society comes from the mind. Society is the repository, like a reservoir, into which everything that comes from the mind flows. It is in this way that there is faith in society, because it first of all in the mind. It went out from the mind and settled in society. Faith is older than society and the family, and consequently older than education. Education gives back to the newborn that which was previously introduced into the family and society from the mind. And so he's sort of acknowledging with her, you know, these aspects of human existence that are deeply formative, and how education affects us, and that how we pass things on from one generation to the next. But I think he's doing all of this in order that faith might be elevated in her mind as superior, that it exists prior to all of these realities, because he who created society and created the family is the one who also gives this gift. that within the mind of God, that this exists from eternity. And in this sense, that it has far greater value and offers us something far more. Therefore, he says, establish, if you will, a little more firmly the conviction in your mind that education develops only what is in human nature, but adds nothing new to it. If it develops faith, that is because it is in human nature. No one should be able to teach you to know God and worship him if this were not in the human spirit on account of some unassailable law. Here we see that there is religious belief in every race of man. The most primitive men have it, because without it, man is not man. If some well-educated men do not believe, this does not mean that they have made great strides forward or have achieved great heights. Instead, it means that they have departed from human nature. They have distorted and mutilated themselves like someone who puts out his own eyes or cuts off his nose. If everyone has faith, it follows that the norm of human life undeniably includes faith. Consequently, he who does not have faith departs from this norm and is a moral freak. All non-believers are of this order. That's not very PC. And I'm sure most people reading this would freak out upon reading it. But, you know, I think what he's putting forward here is that faith is something essential to our humanity. It's sort of an interesting idea that without faith, man is not man. That, you know, we have this vision, and one might call it this Star Trek New Generation vision, that somehow through in and through technology, that we are going to move past, you know, this kind of superstitious nonsense and, you know, elevate ourselves through knowledge and through technology to this higher state. And basically, Theophan is saying, you know, it's a bunch of nonsense, and that's it's an illusion. And not only an illusion, it's like plucking out one's own eye or cutting off one's nose, that you are, in a sense, mutilating yourself by setting aside that which is an essential part of you and what God has given you, faith. And so he states it with such a powerful way. Such a person is a moral freak. And all non-believers of this order are of this order. And, you know, I don't think we would use this or quote this in our conversations with people. I don't think that would be very wise. But I think what he's saying here is essential in the sense of who we are as human beings. And, you know, that what often is celebrated within the culture and what often seems to even appeal to us and our sensitivities and sensibilities, you know, the flash of new technology, everything that sort of draws us in, that elevates our sense of self, it all has to do about ego, but false ego. It's a false self that is being elevated. And what we are actually doing is diminishing ourselves as human beings by stepping away from what is most essential to who we are. And so our failure to cultivate the faith that God has given to us is self-destructive. And we become moral freaks, because then what happens to us is we lose our capacity to perceive reality and to understand it on a profound level, and not simply between what is right and wrong, but I think even to perceive and interpret reality in a truthful fashion. Like this, think about this for a minute. This happens often to children that have been abused at a very early age, pre-verbal, one would say. And it's often in this period where this relationship between mother, father, child, that a child begins to begins to internalize the symbols through which we understand each other, sort of symbolic reality, and then begins to perceive the reality around them in and through this relationship with the parents. And also it's then that a kind of capacity to understand morality develops too. The father becomes the symbolic no between the mother and the child that wants to sustain this eternal union that exists between the two of them, that, you know, the mommy and me are one kind of thing. The father is sort of like the symbolic no there, that you are an individual. And so the child is pushed in a sense into this fuller reality of human existence. And when this is disrupted on a profound level through neglect or through abuse, and that capacity to perceive reality is diminished, it's not as though it can be regained later in life. This is something that takes place in those earliest moments of our formation as human beings. And so later in life, when perception of reality is formed in such a way that it's not like you can help a person reshape that perception of reality. It is what it is in the mind. And I've mentioned this a couple of times, that some psychoanalysts say that the way that things have been going within our world and what people experience often in those early formative years, each generation manifests a particular psychological problem that tends to dominate depending on what is going on within the culture and society. And oftentimes you'll see certain patterns begin to emerge. And what they speculate is what we will probably see in coming generation is a rise of psychosis, that our formation as human beings is on some levels becoming so distorted that we're going to see greater and greater aberrations and this incapacity to enter into reality with any kind of ease. And maybe it becomes impossible. And a person either has to twist that reality in such a way, and reality has to allow that twisting to take place for them, or in order for them to exist within it, accept the kind of psychosis, or they can't exist within it. And so, you know, this, we can't look at faith as just like this personal kind of thing. It certainly is personal, and we understand it as a gift, but we also understand it as a fundamental aspect and reality of who we are as human beings. And so if one willfully neglects it or cuts it out, there is this kind of mutilation on the very depths of who we are as human beings. And then that mutilation manifests itself in the society and culture as a whole. And so this kind of moral freak that he's talking about can actually become sort of the color of the culture itself, that things become more and more bizarre. And, you know, I think as a priest, you know, and living in a city, you know, and being in a university setting for almost, you know, for over 30 years now, I've certainly seen like shifts in the culture, the university culture, and what goes on, and the things that we encounter in engaging young people, the experiences that they have growing up are often nothing like I experienced. And the kinds of things that they are dealing with that affects the way that they view themselves, others, society, and God are profound. And so, you know, the church has to be deeply immersed in the faith, and one would say heroically and radically so, to be an instrument of healing. And it's only going to be by the grace of God that such healing can take place. It's not going to become come through, you know, our arguing things in a deeper way or, you know, greater programs within a parish. You know, it's going to be through this radical transformation by the grace of God that is uninhibited within us and brings that what we see in the gospel Christ do for individuals begins to be made manifest through his church. And so we see Christ healing lepers, you know, or those who were crippled or those possessed by demons. And, you know, that arises by the grace and the of God and the action of his Spirit and is something that is going to have to be made manifest through us. And I think whenever we see a renewal within the life of the church and we see the you know, the arising of saints, we see this kind of tremendous healing take place within the culture in which they exist and within the church. And we've often talked about the Counter-Reformation period and this whole group of saints that emerged, many of whom knew each other, you know, we've often talked about Rome in particular with St. Philip Neri, Camillus de Lellis, Ignatius of Loyola, the Bellarmines, you know, the whole host of these saintly individuals who radically embraced the gospel in their life and with a kind of freedom, and so became these powerful forces of transformation, not by their personal gifts, certainly alone, but by the powerful action of God's grace within them, you know, living the faith in a heroic fashion. So embracing that gift that God has given to us and opening oneself up to it more and more, that gift of faith. You know, part of our problem is that we don't see our dignity and our identity as sons and daughters of God. What Christ has made possible for us. Can I repeat my favorite story or will everybody get mad at me? You know, the story of the two desert fathers, you know, the one where the young monk says, you know, I've kept all the rule and, you know, my prayer life and everything. And what else is there to do? And the, I think it's Elder Joseph or Abelot says, turns around and puts his hands in the air and all fingers become fire like lanterns. And he says to the young monk, why not become all fire? You know, why not be so consumed by the Spirit of God that you become all fire and the presence of God, you know, within this world? And with Philip Neri in particular, I think what is always so beautiful about him is that, you know, we don't know a whole lot that surrounds that mystical experience within the catacombs, but the little we know is that he was praying in particular for the gift of the Spirit, that he had a particular devotion to the Holy Spirit and was praying that God would fill him with the Spirit, and the Spirit enters into him and in through his mouth and lodges in his chest and expands the heart to the point that the ribs break outwards and his heart palpitates at mass, that it shakes the room. He elevates off the ground. You know, he raised the dead. You know, multiple people were healed through him. We're closer to our own day, someone like Saint, oh my gosh, why am I having trouble? He's my favorite saint, and I can't remember. Must be talking.
Yep.
No.
Charbel?
Charbel, yes. Thank you. Boy, my mind's having trouble tonight. Saint Charbel, you know, I think there are like 20 some thousand miracles attributed to him. And this is, you know, a monk in Lebanon that nobody in the West knew of until, you know, more recently, and yet has had this tremendous impact upon the faith life of so many people and who turned to him from all different places of the world seeking his intercession. And so in some ways, he would be comparable to Padre Pio in that regard. You know, this profound action of God's Spirit that becomes incredibly attractive to individuals because it's a reflection of the beauty of God. So any comments on this letter that we've read so far. Eric Chastain. Uh-oh, here we go.
Actually, I was going to say, you may have encountered The Anatomy of Melancholy by Richard Burton in your English classes at some point.
You mean Richard Burton, the actor, or Richard Burton? Okay, no, then I haven't.
Yeah, Anatomy of Melancholy, that Shakespeare based Hamlet in part on.
Okay.
Well, it turns out that actually he has under his classifications of different forms of melancholy, religious melancholy, and then he puts atheism and just scoffing at religious stuff right. as part of that. So I think there's a long history, and even, you know, even in contemporary psychiatry, there was a paper I saw not too long ago, which profiles basically it correlates atheism and depression. Mm-hmm. And I mean, based on extremely anecdotal evidence, I would also put autism spectrum disorder tied with, in terms of correlation with atheism as well, I think.
In what way? I'm not making the connect there.
Well, Alan Turing had autism, and he's a very famous atheist. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, and they're, you know, so this is kind of like the, you know, psychiatric correlation with atheism. They're very comorbid, mm-hmm. I would say. And so I think, you know, even from just a medical perspective, it can be kind of, you can kind of back up what Theophan was saying.
Right. And I think I'd be careful in the sense of not attributing one to the other. I would say that the lack of faith might magnify certain psychological issues, you know, in terms of the depth of the depression or the sorrow, lack of sense of meaning and purpose. But, you know, good point. I'd have to look that. I'm not familiar with that to really offer any kind of comment on it, but maybe for next time I'll take a look at some of the things that you mentioned. Maybe actually if you could put it in the chat, that way I could look up some of those references for this coming week, if you wouldn't mind, or just send them to me, that would be good. Okay, folks, we're almost a quarter till here, so we ran a little over, sorry about that, but we'll pick up next time. This is a pretty challenging letter, no doubt, and I've had to read it over a couple of times, and you know, I don't want us to strain it, you know, I think when we read it, and try to make it say more, and I think maybe I've gone even further than I needed to here, I think, in talking about certain things to make a point, but I think the fundamental issues that he puts forward here are important for us about faith itself and the lack of faith and the impact that that has on the individual. And I think that's basically what he's trying to communicate to Anastasia. Okay. But we'll pick up there next time. You know, any further questions or comments, clarifications, you know, feel free to bring them. Okay. Making headway. John Climacus is calling. Come on, folks. You could do it. You could finish this up so we can start by Lent. So, okay. Why don't we close this always with our Father, in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. Amen. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. The Lord be with you.
And with you.
And may God bless you, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Go in peace.
Thank you, Father.
Thank you all, and have a wonderful night.
You too.
Again, don't hesitate to send out any comments or questions. Always glad. to have them.
Also, just a little announcement that starting with this month, Schola Christi, which is the group on the second Saturday of every month, is no longer going to be live streamed on YouTube. You can participate actively via Zoom. Or you could just watch, but it'll kind of work like Father David will have his computer right in front of him at the podium. So you'll be able to see his face up close, and then whoever has their camera turned on the screen will be visible on the projector. So when they ask questions, it's like having them in the room. So there'll be a new format. You can more actively participate, but don't go to YouTube for it.
Yeah, I enjoy this format better. I mean, if we have to use technology and in order to make it accessible to others, I like being able to see people and able to have them interact more dynamically. And I found with our YouTube streaming, you know, people can leave questions or comments there, but it's not as personal. And so I like the Zoom a lot. And so if we can make this work, I'm in favor.
We will not be uploading to YouTube afterwards. It will be, the sound will be pulled off and it will become a podcast like they currently are, but there will not be a recorded video component moving forward.
Yeah, we're finding more and more people prefer podcasts because they can listen in the car and things like that rather than watching a video of something. They can be moving about and doing other things. Another, just one final issue before we let you go, that there's with Podbean, where all the podcasts for the groups are found, they've changed all of their, what is it, templates.
It's all the widgets, yeah, and all the templates.
Templates, right. Yeah. And so it's going to look a little bit different, and they've removed something that we've questioned them about, which is the archiving functions, where a person can go back and look for a podcast on a particular year. And we were asking them, why would you remove this? Because then does a person have to sift back through 450 podcasts to get back to one of the early ones to listen to it? And so we're trying to figure out, there are some ways
moving forward, each book will be categorized as a season. It's what we found. We're able to have particular pages that go directly to complete seasons of podcasts. And so each book will be its own season, and they'll be numbered in order. So the very first thing that was the themes of the Philokalia 10 years ago now is season one. This new Ladder of Divine Ascent will begin season eight. Theophan is season six. The Evrictinos is season seven, if you're following along. And then you'll be able to select that. And then when you do go to that season's page, all the episodes of the season will appear there on one page, and you won't even have to load more. So that should work for now.
Yeah, but it'll take us a little bit of time to get things set up.
Yes.
Just know we're on it, and we're working with Podbean trying to figure out everything that we can do to make it easy to navigate and find.
The Evrigatinos is all set, but to make things a season, you have to go into every episode and edit it. So it's just going to take me a wee bit of time.
Okay, everybody, have a wonderful night. Good to see you as always.